The business of culture, the culture of business, markets, policy, media, and technology, authors, creatives, so much more. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
Yeah, and that's why Jessica, or Sally in the book, that's why she made a home on the 9th floor, because a lot of people wouldn't climb up that high. Most squatters stayed on the first two floors, on the first floor and the second floor, and didn't climb up that high.
Well, this week, I wanted to tell some of Miami's story through the eyes of Vanessa Sinclair, a psychotherapist who was, for a time, a homeless teen in Miami's grunge-era mean streets, crashing at the abandoned Mutiny Hotel and bumping into Marilyn Manson in Nine Inch Nails. 3 decades after I left for college and Vanessa was kicked out of her house, our books and social media have conspired to converge the paths of two children of Miami. Stay tuned for this. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Joining me from a small town in Sweden, it is such a small world, is Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, author of the new novel, Things Happen. This is described as coming of age in 1990s Florida, sex and drugs and dark music, goth and fetish clubs, abandoned cocaine gangster hotels, love and violence, friendships that last for life and beyond, a psychedelic underground in pastel-colored Miami. Ivy and her girlfriends roll with the crazy Florida waves and vibes and weirdos as they learn the ropes of reality, so-called, and things happen. They really do. Vanessa, welcome, for starters.
Thank you for having me. Things now, really you do and happen I, in Miami.
Yeah, you and I are both children of Miami, and we were connected, for people who see this on video, that's Vanessa, at the then-abandoned Hotel Mutiny at Sailboat Bay, the subject of my book, Hotel Scarface. That's 30 years ago. And to think, I mean, it strains credulity that a place went from this den of opulence where people were literally pouring $40,000 worth of Dom Perignon down the hot tubs to a crack and goth den abandoned within 10 years. And it really tells the through line of the sexual revolution and the stoner 70s and cocaine madness and the fall of Miami and the violence and everything and the savings and loan crisis and paying the tab for the decade of excess. And you and I connected after the book came out because you told me that when you had a stretch of homelessness, you came from an insecure house, that you squatted there in the early 90s. And to think 30 years later, you're now a PhD, you're a psychoanalyst in Sweden. I just had to have you on the show. I had to invoke that Miami because it's a very lost era.
Absolutely. And I love how our books connect. It's like now you know what those goths hanging out the windows were doing. Now you get inside their minds, our minds.
The desperation of it, you know, everything that 1980s Miami came to represent in the public eye, the pastel colors, Miami Vice, Brickell Avenue, the opulence of the 80s after it was essentially a failed state by 1980 and 1981 with all the violence and drug murders. That too was a myth, what we experienced 1980s on Friday night on Miami Vice. And I just remember a lot of my friends, by the time grunge came out, Nirvana's Nevermind was it in 1992, there was a really dark side to everything. There were kids who were, if not homeless or runaways, they were barely housed. There were latchkey kids, all sorts of gangs marauding across Miami. Underage sex, various terrible things going on, experimentation with cocaine and crack and heroin. And it was interesting to me that you, as a product of an elite, what was it? You went to Ransom Everglades as an elementary school kid. How did that all fall apart for you?
Hurricane Andrew. Hurricane Andrew happened.
1992. Yeah. Mm-hmm. August of 92. Tell me about that.
Yeah. My parents were holding it together pretty well until then. But yeah, Hurricane Andrew happened. And what I've learned from being a psychoanalyst, which everyone should know, if there's anything really traumatic that's happened in your childhood, then you should be aware that when your child turns that same age, that could bring a lot of that up for you as an adult. So basically, my mom was sent away from her house house when she was 16 and like married to this guy that was in the military. Her father was a military man and like sent off to Germany. And she didn't want to go and she didn't want to marry this guy, but she was kind of sent away. And then when Hurricane Andrew happened, I was 15, so I was around the same age, and something just seemed to like snap in her mind. And she basically did the same thing. She threw my dad out and then she threw me out. And I don't know exactly what she was doing. She said she was trying to make a better life, but she had like hooked up with some guy who was like a contractor and like went to Texas for several months and just like left basically. Yeah. And that's how I ended up being like wandering the Grove. I mean, I was already wandering the Grove a little bit before that and had some friends there. And like teenagers used to hang out in Peacock Park a lot back then. So we would just kind of all meet up in the park and hang out.
You went to elementary school right across the street from the Mutiny at a church.
Yeah.
Right? Your preschool.
Yeah, exactly. At St. Stephen's.
That's crazy.
So I was that area.
Did you know anything about what was going on in that tower, in that den of iniquity?
No idea. When we were squatting there in 90, 92, 93, 94, we knew that it was like an abandoned like disco hotel. That's how we thought of it. Like it was an old disco place, but we had no idea the extent. I didn't know the extent until I read your book, which was just a few years ago. So this is all very new, actually, to me.
Vanessa, tell me, I don't want to sound cliche and then I'm talking to a psychoanalyst here. You see so many patients across the pond in the United States through telemedicine and what the technologies we have now. What was your childhood like?
I was an only child. And my parents are both kind of, I was actually just talking to my dad about this yesterday. We're all kind of loners. Like my dad was always basically, he's a construction worker. So he was always on a site. And then when we would come home, he would just kind of sit outside and like listen to Jimmy Buffett and like drink Budweiser and smoke Marlboro Reds. You know, he's like a Marlboro guy. And my mom's a painter, like an artist. And so she would always be like in her studio. My dad built her a little studio behind our house. So she would always be in her studio. So I basically entertained myself a lot and like, yeah, made up games and played in the yard and just hung out alone and did a lot of things
like
that.
But did you feel loved or nurtured? Was there fighting that kind of made you say that I could seek more bonding and friendship outside of this house?
No, there wasn't fighting. They're just kind of, my parents are more, their traumas, they're more like shut down. You know, they don't act out much. They're just kind of like shut down. Like my dad was drafted right out of high school because it was the Vietnam era. And he didn't go to Vietnam per se, but he was in the Navy on a submarine. So he's got this like, he doesn't have like this war, like explosion fighting trauma. He's got this kind of sitting and waiting for the bad thing to happen trauma. Where he's just like in a submarine for months, wondering if they were going to get blown up, you know? And my mom, yeah, she's also just very, they're just kind of very in denial. My mom definitely like blocks things out. So like when I first brought up like me being kicked out, like she just said, I would never do that. And I was like, really? And then after we had like many conversations about it, she would say, I see how you could see it that way. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, well, she said, I expected you to just sleep at other people's houses, like your friends' houses for a few months. And I was like, well, did you call anyone's parents and like make arrangements for me to like stay at their house for a couple of months? Like as if you can do that even. And she's like, no. And I'm like, okay. So she just basically figured I would like take care of myself and be able to sleep at people's houses for months on end.
So let's illustrate this because it's a critical point in my book. It's the big reset button that was pressed for Miami, the most catastrophic hurricane to hit South Florida since the Great One of 1926. I was there August of 1992. Since I grew up in North Miami, it hit us not nearly as hard as you guys closer to the Grove and Cutler Ridge and the epicenter, really close to the epicenter. Homestead got walloped, South Dixie Highway. I remember the Burger King headquarters. Just unbelievable damage as you saw the news choppers going above this the following day. You lived right in the Grove or nearby, or you lived on Douglas Road?
Yeah, I lived on Douglas close to Edgewater. And so we actually didn't stay in our house. So the day before Hurricane Andrew was Lollapalooza 92.
That's amazing.
So I was at Lollapalooza and then hanging out with my boyfriend.
Was that at the Orange Bowl?
No, it was in Bicentennial Park.
Wow. Lollapalooza in the heart of downtown Miami in Bicentennial Park. The day before Hurricane Andrew hit. Go ahead.
The day before. Yeah, it was fun. And so it went from like a really fun time to like a really not so fun time. And I was there with my boyfriend and his older sister, basically. And when his dad picked us up, he's Marco in the book. When his dad picked us up, he just said, like, there's a hurricane coming. But, you know, that happened a lot, you know, so we were just like, whatever. Crying and then wolf. We ended up, like, my parents picked me up at his house, and they thought, my mom used to, like, house sit for these people who, this guy was, like, a very high VP of an oil company, and they had their winter house in Snapper Creek. And so my parents, our house was old for Miami. It was from 1913, and it wasn't in good condition, so it was, like, always under construction. And my dad, like I said, he was a construction worker, so he was always fixing it up, and things were kind of, like, wiring for the house was exposed and things like that. So they thought, oh, better to stay in these, like, rich people's house during the hurricane than in our, like, house that's falling apart. And then, yeah, of course, that drove us farther south. So we ended up going, like, more towards the center of the storm. And we actually were in the eye of the hurricane, which was really, I can't even describe what that's like. It's like nothing you can really, imagine.
That was the last stand for you with your mom and dad, riding out that hurricane under one roof.
Yeah, that was in August of 92. And then we started school as normal. This was my last year at Ransom. But I remember we didn't have electricity or even running water when school started. And then my mom kicked my dad out, like, that autumn. Then she kicked me out, like, in the spring. She just said, basically, I needed to, like, sleep out of people's houses for the summer, and that I could come back when school started in the fall.
Could I understand how that conversation went? Again, you have to, I'm conceding to you the extent of imposter syndrome, and that I'm asking a renowned psychoanalyst here about that. How did that conversation go with your mother? I don't understand. Like, was it at the kitchen table? Can you, like, find somewhere else to, you know, sleep?
We didn't have really kitchen table conversations. this is just how she was. She just said basically that she had hooked up with the guy who was, like, contracted to work on our house, and she basically was going to go to Texas with him. And yeah, she said she'd be back in the autumn and I could come back when school started. So
old were you in the spring of 93?
Yeah, and like I said, when I confront her about it, she says, I see how you could see it that way. But she actually told me that she trusted me and thought that I would, she trusted me to be able to take care of myself. But
and so
when
what
you're
about
15,
your father?
You feel very old. So I was like, okay, I'll just go hang out with my friends.
What about your father? Was your father any sort of sanctuary for you? Could you turn to him and say, look, maybe you didn't have the vernacular to say she's having a breakdown and we need to bond, or dad? You just didn't have that relationship with your father.
No, he was actually working in Sarasota at the time. So he was already gone, like, all of the weekdays at that point. Because he had just go work wherever the job was. And that's how construction is. So when she kicked him out, he just basically stayed in Sarasota full time instead of coming home on the weekends, which is what he was doing before.
I don't understand. You can't get on a payphone and say, Dad, could I crash with you? Mom is having a crisis. It wasn't like that.
No, it wasn't like that. And also, like, I just found out from him recently, like, in the past year, that he actually had also had a new girlfriend. So basically, my parents had, like, new people they were interested in and just basically forgot about me. That's what it seems like. But my dad assumed that my mom was taking care of me, because I guess why wouldn't he? But yeah, I mean, I've also been, like, I moved to Tampa for a while, and I've been, like, a couple of years without seeing my parents, you know, like, just after high school, because they, didn't come visit me. I think they both came to visit me once when I was in Tampa.
I'm joined from Sweden by Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, author of the new novel, Things Happen. This is coming of age in 1990s Miami, sex and drugs and dark music, goth and fetish clubs. It's like post-lapsarian Miami, when all of the glamour and pastel colors of the 1980s fell apart, and you were kicked. I mean, the hurricane, we talked August of 92, Hurricane Andrew hit the big reset button on that. Your mom essentially evicts you. We could call it a low-key eviction, but whatever you want to call it, a rose by any name, by the spring of 1993, and you're 15 years old, and you are essentially homeless, and you pair up with, was it your friend Ivy?
My friend, I pair up with Sally.
Yeah. So tell me about your friend who was an outright runaway.
Yeah. Sally was a runaway. She ran away because she did come from, like, a more abusive home that was much more chaotic than my home. And she ran away when she was 12. So she was on her own already for a long time. She was born in the Grove at Dinner Key, like, on a boat, and grew up living on a boat with her parents. And then, yeah, she ran away when she was 12. And she had already, like, set up a little place to stay at the Mutiny on the 9th floor.
So let me illustrate this for everybody, because, again, it blows my mind. Imagine a hotel by a marina. For those of you who are not familiar with the Hotel Mutiny at Sailboat Bay, the subject of my book, Hotel Scarface, there's an anchorage and a marina, Dinner Key Marina, where you'd have millionaires and hobos alike would be living off their boats. I mean, David Crosby of Crosby and Nash and Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, the late David Crosby, had his boat there, developed a horrific freebase cocaine addiction there. There were millionaires. There was Bebe Rebozo and best friends of Richard Nixon bringing their yacht into the marina. And all these characters would cross paths. I mean, Peacock Park, the adjacent park, which was created in the late 19th century, you had all these hippies and hacky sack people and Hare Krishnas and patchouli people. And so she's born into that kind of crucible, all of it being overlooked by this hotel and discotheque where there were raging orgies and celebrities and the place to be in late 1970s, early 80s Miami. So she's kind of born into that crucible, and you are raised just a few blocks away. Indeed, you go to this church school right across from that hotel. You reconnect by 1993 when the crack epidemic is raging. And where did you reconnect? Where did you meet? Where did you find kind of mutual shelter?
I'm assuming just in the Grove. I think it might have been at the Kitchen Club, because we used to hang out at the Kitchen Club a lot. So my mind makes me believe that we just met again at the Kitchen Club. But it also could have just been from around the Grove, because there was always just like kids hanging out like in front of TCBY or Joffrey's or whatever, like sitting on the street. And basically, like, if I saw anyone that I thought was interesting, I would just like say hi to them and be like, we're friends now. And I'd just like take them to the park, and yeah, they'd just be our friend. So
there was you guys using the Miami Subs bathroom, the Miami Subs restaurant, which was there, something else right now. You were washing yourselves in the movie theater restroom underneath the escalator at Cocoa Walk. I mean, this mm-hmm. is a scene. This was a nightlife scene in Miami where you could bump into everyone. There was a Johnny Rockets on the corner. That era for the Grove is definitely over. But were these people called the Grove Rats?
The Grove Rats. That's what the police called us, apparently. The Grove Rats.
So that was your epicenter around the heart of, you know, Cocoa Walk and Mayfair and McFarland Avenue. And you just understood that you were all kind of low-key homeless and you were looking for support in numbers?
Yeah, exactly. There were also people that would come in from out of town. Like people, this one kid that like ran away from his house in Texas, ended up in Florida somehow. And there were things like the Rainbow Gathering that would come through town. And people would come and, like you said, there'd be like hacky sack and people playing like throwing fire and playing juggling and things like that. There's like all sorts of weird things going through town all the time back then. And then, of course, there's all the festivals in the Grove that would happen. But there was like a whole camp out like behind the baseball field. Like there was all these mangroves that are now townhouses between like the baseball field and the barnacle. And there was like a whole camp out back there where people had tents and slept back there and just like basically lived in the park, you know.
Really bohemian existence, going back to the days of the Grove, if you read about it, in the middle of the 20th century, where nobody would lock their doors and the roosters would chase after mailmen and people would sun topless in the park and no one would shave their armpits. And a lot of that transmogrified into the violence that we saw and the kind of the cosmopolitan grandeur, you know, the danger and the splendor of everything that it became in the late 70s and early 80s. What was your introduction to hard drugs?
I mean, it's just Miami, so.
So it's around. Marijuana, pot is table stakes back then, right? Right. So yeah. You're in middle school or high school and you tried pot, but what were the other things that were put in front of you? Because I remember it was an essential part of club life in South Beach and even in the Grove.
Yeah. I mean, none of that really even ever started for me until I was 15, until that year when I got kicked out. I was pretty much like an angel before then. I've always been like a straight A student and always did well in school, even when I got kicked out and had issues at home and stuff like that. I still always did really well in school. So it was really just from being around in the Grove all the time during that period when everything like that started.
What did you try?
I mean, it's Miami. Everything's around. I've tried everything at some point or another.
And I read in this book, there are times that, you know, either it be a boyfriend or an acquaintance or something, there's always this specter of attempted rape. Like, this is what I don't understand, is that there's power in numbers and whatnot, but also people taking advantage of people who've fallen through the cracks. And you have to push that aside. I mean, you use a character in the book in Ivy, but this is you fending for yourself and still going to school at age 15 when you are homeless.
Yeah, and that's why Jessica, or Sally in the book, that's why she made a home on the 9th floor, because a lot of people wouldn't climb up that high. Most squatters stayed on the first two floors, on the first floor and the second floor, and didn't climb up that high. So
would you illustrate that for me? So to recap it for people, look up the Hotel Mutiny at Sailboat Bay. It's in the new series Griselda. There's going to be a series coming up on Amazon Plus where they kind of stole my concept, but that's neither here nor there. This was the great hotel and discotheque, had a bunch of funky rooms. It hit its peak in the late 70s and early 80s. It was sold at the end of 1983, fell victim to the savings and loan crisis, was all but abandoned by 1990. Hurricane Andrew in 92 did a number on it. I mean, if you saw a picture of South Bayshore Drive, there were boats from that very marina that were lifted up onto South Bayshore Drive. And this place by 1992, 1993 was at best a kind of a goth skateboarder's hangout, and at worst, kind of an outright crack den, an abandoned building. The government had owned it. The Federal Something Insurance Corporation, which took over all these properties because the mortgage had failed on the bank. So oddly enough, there's this tower overlooking your childhood home in Coconut Grove in Miami, and it's now this new den of iniquity where just desperation hangs out. Can you illustrate that scene for me? I understand that Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails were performing on the roof.
They didn't perform there, but they hung out there before. There was one night that at some point my friend Sally had hooked up with somebody that was in the band of Nine Inch Nails. And it wasn't, you know, the main singer, but it was like one of the bass player or the drummer or something like that. And yeah, and then just we got to hang out at their house that they were staying in on Key Biscayne. And they came to the Grove and hung out with us where Sally was staying.
They were recording the soundtrack, I think, for Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, exactly. To
go back and look at it. And that proximity to people, really on the foot of the mountain of grunge and whatever the movement is. Did you know how big a deal Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor and Marilyn Manson would be?
Definitely not the Spooky Kids, as I call them. Definitely not. They were just like a local band like any other local bands. There were lots of local bands in Miami at the time, like that were punk, like, you know, Against All Authority and Quid and Matu's Struggle and so many things. So they were just kind of another one of those bands. And I wasn't that into them, but I had a friend that was really into them. And she used to always drive us because they were in like Fort Lauderdale instead of in Miami proper. And of course, when you're in Miami, you're like, why would I ever go to Fort Lauderdale? You know, like, why would I leave Miami? Like, that's what, Broward? What are you talking about? But I had a friend that was obsessed with them and used to drive us like every weekend to go see them. They used to play at the Button South all of the time, and they played at Churchill's a couple of times. So they play at Washington Square. So at some point when they came down towards Miami, we hung out with them more then. But at the time, it wasn't a big deal also to like be at after parties with bands like that, because they were just local bands. And yeah, they were always all ages shows. So there was always a lot of teenagers around and things like that. I actually couldn't really understand when Marilyn Manson became as big as they did, because it just was odd to me that something that was like so specific to our like local scene would be like something that people would know internationally. I just didn't understand that concept for a long time.
Vanessa, what would you guys do for food when you were kind of a person without a kind of a homeland at that point, when you were wandering as a homeless person in early 93?
We bummed quarters. I would bum quarters a lot and tell people, ask adults if I could have a quarter to call my mom. So I get quarters that way, and then eat like Miami Subs. You could get like a pita bread with cheese and bacon. The pita bread with cheese was like 50 cents, and you could add bacon for like a dollar. So I would bum quarters and eat at Miami Subs, or go to Fuddruckers and like eat their salad bar basically without ordering a burger. Yeah, so you find ways like that. It was mostly Miami Subs and Fuddruckers.
And you're all being treated like so many pigeons or seagulls, as the Grove Rats, as a bunch of marauding kids. Like the business owners, you had hacks. Like, you would come in through the back door at Miami Subs, right, where the mutiny was, and there was a, you know, the beaten down garage, and you could come in and use the bathroom and come in with a roll of quarters and buy a couple of things of pita. or bathe yourself at the movie theater bathroom. I mean, it's just, it blows my mind. I don't know how my 15-year-old mind would have compartmentalized that.
Yeah, I think also, like, I always saw it as, like, the people working at Miami Subs and stuff, like, they're also making minimum wage, so I don't think they cared that much about, like, bothering us, you know what I mean? They just, like, they probably knew that we were just, like, living around the corner and they didn't mind. That's what it seemed like. And then we had friends that, like, you know, were more normal high school kids that, like, a friend that worked at TCBY and they'd give us, like, free ice cream, or I had a friend whose dad owned Haagen-Dazs, so we get free ice cream that way, too. So things like that, you know. And a lot of kids hanging out in the park, like, did have homes to go home to. They just came there to, like, party on the weekends, you know? So it was kind of, I don't even know that we thought of it that much as, like, us being that different from the rest of the teenagers. I think that, I guess, because there's, like, so many different levels. Like my friend Sally in the book, like, her level was, like you said, like, she was born, you know, on a boat in Dinderkey and had a much harder life. But I don't think, like, I didn't see this, like, kind of classist thing so much, like, of people being in different social classes, or we were just kind of all teenagers hanging out in the park and everyone was going through their own stuff. And even when I went over to a friend's house that had, like, really, like, obviously insanely fancy houses, you know, and really rich parents, I still didn't think of it as, like, them being, like, I don't know, like, better, like, in a classist way or anything. It was just like, okay, this is where this person lives. And I don't really know why that is, because, of course, now it's so obvious to me. But for some reason, I didn't think of it that way. And I think maybe, I think my parents, like, my mom especially, doesn't really think about people that way. So I just never, I never really thought of it that way so much.
Full disclosure, stay with us. Full Disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the podcatchers. The link, please subscribe, rate us, and rave if you would so like, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. We are on all social media at handle fulldradio. Note that while we have to cap the length of this show for broadcast around 52 minutes, most of our episodes go long. All of the conversations in their entirety are available on pod. Again, the link is fulldradio.com, and please feel free to get in touch. My DMs, alas, are always open. If you are just joining us, my esteemed guest is Dr. Vanessa Sinclair, joining us from a small town in Sweden, actually. Her new novel is Things Happen. This is a child of Miami, like me, and our worlds intersected because my book came out in 2017, Hotel Scarface, where cocaine cowboys partied and plotted to control Miami. And over the ether of the interwebs, Dr. Sinclair gets in touch to say, I lived there as a homeless teenager. And so this story is coming of age in 1990s Miami, sex and drugs and dark music, goth and fetish clubs, abandoned cocaine gangster hotels. You have this picture on the back, and you've been very discreet about sharing these photos and the identity of your, you know, now deceased friends. That's when you were living in the abandoned hotel Mutiny in 1993. That's you in the abandoned garage. I mean, did you leave the house with a suitcase when your mother evicted you?
Yep. I just put a backpack on and walked to the Grove.
You put a backpack on, walked to the Grove. You still went to high school at Coral Gables High?
Yeah. When school came back in session in the fall, I went to Gables. It was between switching from Ransom to Gables. So basically, I was in Ransom from 92 to 93 that year. And then I was still hanging out in the park. And obviously, like I remember talking to my principal at some point and him saying, like giving me a talking to, like, your friends seem to not be the best. Like, you might be going in not a good direction. But I don't think he ever talked to my parents, which is also interesting in retrospect. But I remember,
it's not like you could have shot back, like, actually, my mom's having a breakdown and I'm living in the park and in a hotel, in an abandoned hotel in Cocoa Grove. I mean, what were you doing for clothing? You had one change of clothes. Where would you wash your clothes?
And we had lots of clothes. Jessica had, like, a whole trunk full of clothes. And most of the time that I was staying there was in between, was during the summer between 93 and 94. So I started Gables in 1994. And then I did go back to my mom's house, but then my mom was out of town a lot because she still had this boyfriend or whatever in Texas. So I was home that summer, at the end of that summer for that school year. But my mom just wasn't there a lot. So
draw the tableau for me. I faintly remember I was playing a softball game at that park. There was a hot dog vendor at the corner of South Bayshore Drive in front of the abandoned Mutiny in the late 80s or early 90s. When did you first walk into that hotel? Did you walk in through the back? It was fenced. It was owned by the government. I guess your friend, call her Sally, held your hand and walked you in. What was the scene like?
Yeah, we hung out there before I was actually staying there with her. People would just hang out there and hang out on the roof. So we'd go there like after being at a club during the night from the Grove or after being in the park. And she walked us through the fence. There was like a fence, an opening in the fence where it was kind of pulled back by the Miami Subs on that corner.
Behind the garage, building. Yeah.
And so we went in that way up the stairwell over there. That's where we would go in and out. We never went in the front. And I didn't understand at all what the building actually was supposed to look like as far as like when it was a functioning hotel. Like you had mentioned, there was like, oh, it was by the pool. I'm like, I didn't even really realize like how it was set up so much. It was also usually pretty dark.
You were just going through a stairwell and climbing up to the roof?
Yeah, we climbed up to the 9th floor and then from the 9th floor up to the roof.
So, you know, you talk about an upstairs, downstairs in the book in Plan 9, which is what your friend made this pseudo sanctuary on the 9th floor. You talk about the elevator being a really dark place. There was a smell emanating from it. There was a rumor that someone had died there. The first 2 floors were very vagranty, crack addicty.
Yeah.
What was the kind of the topography of the place?
That's why we would just like, yeah, we would scoop by the first 2 floors very quickly. You know, we just like get through really quickly. We didn't hang out there at all. And went back up to the 9th floor. And she had a bed set up and like a trunk full of clothes and things like that. And a little boom box in her corner of the 9th floor. And then the rest of it was just empty. I mean, everything was just gray cinder blocks. And there wasn't any like drywall on the walls or rooms that you could differentiate. It was really just like completely blown out.
So that to illustrate that, just a 10-year difference, the Eagles plausibly sold, who stayed at this hotel and partied there and recorded next door. They talk about mirrors on the ceiling, pink champagne on ice. Every one of its 130 rooms in its heyday was a different theme. Nautical dreams, Calypso, Marrakesh, Shoeji screens, Japanese rooms. And by the time that it was so derelict that the feds held an auction in 1990 to strip literally everything out and raise money, they were literally pulling out kind of copper pipes. So all that was there was cinder block when you saw it, not even running water.
No, there was no running water or anything like that.
So you had to climb nine floors. Were there, was a lot of drug paraphernalia, broken glass? I don't know. What would you...
I mean, not where we stayed on Planet Nine. It was just, it was just dirty from like dust and concrete dust and things like that. Jessica kept her area like pretty, you know, tidy. She didn't leave like food or anything around like that. She wasn't like smoking crack or anything like that. That was really just the people on the first 2 floors. Ours was more like, just hanging out and drinking, stuff like that. Yeah.
Tell me about her and your conversations. There's you guys, you know, looking at a Playboy centerfold, I think, in that photo, just kind of giggling.
Yeah, this is actually a photo shoot that this kid did who actually went to Ransom. Because we hung out there, like I said, some of the kids that hung out there were just regular high school kids, but it's Miami, so it's Miami.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do a photo shoot there. So we did a photo shoot. And this one, I blocked out her face. This actually isn't Sally. It's a different friend. And I didn't know that she would want to be associated with the book or this story, because most of my friends that live through this kind of time don't really want to be associated
or have their spouses or their professions know that this happened,
you know. So it's actually a different friend, and we did a whole photo shoot with this like high school kid who did these like great black and white pictures, and that's why we have them.
But tell me about your close friend and your host and talking to her and what the conversations would be like.
Yeah, that's why I ended up writing this book, because she was killed during the pandemic in 2020, and it just brought up a lot of time, like thoughts about this time and different memories of this period.
She was again in an abusive relationship, was killed by
her boyfriend. Yeah, he shot her, and he also shot himself. So they're both dead, and that's how the book starts, is with that news. And yeah, and that's what kind of spawned me to write this book and write about this time. And it kind of felt like I wanted to document, you know, what it was like and kind of capture it. And I used the cut up method instead of like a linear narrative to write the book, which I think captures how it felt a lot more too, because felt, the memories sure. are kind of piecemeal and floating around rather than like a linear story. And so, yeah, Jessica, I mean, she's just a wonderful person. She was super caring. She took a lot of different people in, not just me. She was just like very nurturing and maternal in that way. And I think also a lot of kids, and I mean, I'm like that too. I think also when you've had something like that happen and you see how much it helps to have support from like other people, then you always want to be able to support people that are going through a hard time, you know?
How candid would the conversations get with her? I mean, this is the budding psychoanalyst in you 30 years ago, but would there be moments of potential intervention like, look, we don't have to do this. Let's clean it up. I'm going to have a place to stay soon. You can come and live with me, or we can come and do this. You don't really have to live on this kind of edge, because what potentially begets? I mean, you imagine the after-school specials and drug addiction and prostitution and all the various dangers that can confront you in this abandoned hotel, even if you're living seven floors above some of the worst of it.
Yeah. Well, she really didn't have anywhere else to go. So I think that she was making the best situation she could. And soon after, after this kind of peak time of staying here, she ended up meeting a guy who had moved down to Miami with his older sister, and they had an apartment in the Grove, and she ended up living with them. So she ended up having a place to stay after that, and also like throughout her life ended up basically living with her boyfriends, you know, all the way till the end. So she made her way as best she could, I think, and I think she did a pretty good job based on where she came from.
Well, Vanessa, what about your rebound? Now, I want you to illustrate it for me. There had to be some sort of rapprochement with your mother. Again, you're living here while much of Miami, the cleanup is going on in Coconut Grove and South Miami. This was massive. I remember there was such a plywood shortage at Home Depot. The homes were just devastated. There was a shortage of construction workers. As I understand it, you know, you were allowed to kind of squat at your mom's place among all of these shady construction workers. She was just okay to leave you with them.
And this, of course, is when there was no cell phones or anything. So like there was no like constant communication on phones. We would leave each other messages. Like if I called her, or she'd call and leave a message on the home phone. But like, yeah, there wasn't a lot of communication. And so it was wild time. I had parties at the house all the time and kids over, and yeah, we were just always hanging out at my house, basically. So much so that even when I moved away, eventually, like I moved out basically as soon as I was 18 and could move legally. My mom would tell me like people would stop by, like friends would stop by the house to see like if things were going on, because it was kind of like a party house that people would come to, you know.
I'd love for you to read some of page 52 and 53 in your own voice, if you can, that just kind of illustrates the hopelessness, the kind of living the edge on it. Again, I told you offline that this kind of reminds me of a little bit of F. Scott, the people partying in the 1920s in New York before the crash of 29. There was a lost generation. You guys were lost youth. You were the lost children of the 80s in Miami, trying to find yourselves, trying to find each other. And I'd love to hear it in your own voice.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as far as, like you said, for my rapprochement, I think my key was just going to school. And I think that is something my mom instilled in me when I was really young, with putting me in private schools like St. Stephen's and Ransom, was that like school was the most important thing. So I think that's really what got me through, actually, was just like most kids, I think, would have dropped out of school as soon as they turned 16, which a lot of my friends did. But I just kept going to school, and so much so that like when I finished high school, I went to college, and when I finished bachelor's, I went to grad school, and then when I finished that, I went to psychoanalytic training, and I'm still in school now because I'm learning Swedish.
Before we talk so about like, that ridiculously school, unlikely trajectory, I want you to read kind of as a goodbye to that era, if you can, from, you know, 50, any parts of page 52 and 53. I thought that encapsulated. So whenever you'd like.
Sure. So what's your idea? Sally asked as she placed the baggie back into her purse. She held each nostril closed with her thumb and sniffed hard, ensuring all the powder went where it was needed. Hold this, Ivy replied as she handed Sally the cup of ice left over from her drink. That night she was dressed in black latex from head to toe. It turned out this man was the owner of the club. He was wearing torn blue jeans, a black leather vest, and a cowboy hat with matching boots complete with spurs. He looked to be in his early 50s and was another one of those Floridians who looked like they'd been left out in the sun for far too long. Curly gray hairs covered his chest and upper back. I wonder if he had enjoyed this kind of tasty beverage before. There's no lipstick on his collar, but maybe it was blood. I don't know till this day, dear. The Satanic Panic was in full swing, as was the DARE program, with its Just Say No to Drugs campaign. Most kids wouldn't have even known what these drugs were if it weren't for those campaigns. Or satanic rock music, for that matter. If anything, in attempting to supposedly scare kids away from drugs, they actually introduced them all to it. It was truly perverse. When they got back to the house, the front door was wide open, and all the lights in the house were on. The back door was open, too. The police had left the doors ajar and the lights on. Everything inside was in shambles. Gunshots went off. He hadn't had any identification on him and was laying in a hospital, labeled John Doe. Letitia started dating Dom after Ivy broke up with him the first time, and the three of them used to fool around together, a lot. It was delightful, but unfortunately ended abruptly when the three of them were fooling around one night, and Ivy soon realized that she and Dom were going at it, while Letitia was over to one side, with Dom just kind of groping her with one of his hands. When Letitia noticed what was going on, she was enraged. From that point forward, she forbade Dom from ever seeing Ivy again. Not that it stopped them. For nearly a decade, Ivy and Dom were on again, off again. Ivy cheated on every partner she had with Dom, and vice versa. Ivy was dead set on getting out of Florida. She often wondered why people stayed in Miami with these hurricanes disrupting their lives every year. She recalled many times having to go to school and later work with no electricity or even running water.
Now, that was, I want to stop you at that because you did go back to school that fall, right? I mean, what was the impetus in that your friend here had was shacking up with a boyfriend in Coconut Grove and you didn't want to be alone and on the ninth floor?
No, well, my mom, like I said, she said that I could come back at the end of summer when school started again. So I did, because even though I was really mad at her and kind of hated her at that point, it was better than staying there. Yeah, absolutely. So I think I actually went back home before Jess found that the place to stay with this guy and his sister. I can't say for sure exactly, but it kind of
There was no debriefing with your mom. Like, Mom, what did you think I just did? What did you think it was like for me? I was living in a crack den in Coconut Grove.
There was kind of none of that. Yeah, you don't really know my mom. She's an old hippie, basically. I mean, like you mentioned, the hippies in the Grove from that era, and all the kids that we were hanging out in the park were kind of all the kids of those hippies, you know? So she's kind of spaced out. So she's not really like super 100% present. And I don't know that she lives in the same reality that I do. So we don't have these kind of direct conversations like you and I are having. She's just not like that.
You and I discussed it online. You can go pull up what's left of Newsweek if you just Google the Grove of Crack. Coconut Grove became known for its crack epidemic, even though it was high market cocaine, fanciest cocaine dealers and celebrities in the late 70s and early 80s. It was really the crack epidemic that caught up with this. Again, the decade of excess and the bill being due for it. You're at this party, I believe at a motel nearby, where Jennifer Capriati, the world-ranked tennis star, you didn't even know it was her. She was smoking crack, and it was raided by police.
Yeah, she was dating one of my friends, who actually is the exact same friend who I was thinking of when I told you that friends would stop by the house after I had moved out. He actually kept coming by my house later, and my mom gave him money and stuff. But yeah, he ended up being a junkie, like a heroin addict. And he had no idea who his girlfriend was. I don't know if they were going out for a few weeks or a couple of months, but it wasn't very long. And yeah, none of us had any idea. We had hung out with her several times before she got in trouble.
And everybody would wonder in the national press, it was in People magazine, everywhere, you're a millionaire, nationally renowned tennis star, globally renowned tennis star. Why would you be, you know, getting this huge piercing in your nose and smoking crack? But people didn't understand what was going on at home or the unhappiness that she had as a teenager, maybe being foisted onto tennis tennis being foisted onto her ever since she was a kid in preschool.
Yeah, I would assume so. But yeah, absolutely. Especially like with the nose ring and everything. I never imagined she was like some high Olympic level athlete. That definitely never crossed my mind.
You doubled down in school, and I understand that it did take you some extra time. You went and you had great grades. You had great preparation and you got your associate's degree. I think you went to what was Miami-Dade Community College when you finished up.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess
high school and then went to community college because, yeah, my mom parents weren't together enough to like help me get college applications in. And I wasn't together enough either for that. So
you did it. I mean, was there a support system at school? But this was Coral Gables High School by then that recognized you were a promising but at risk youth. I know it sounds cliche again, but that's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, I got this like Florida Scholars Fund, it was called. Which I guess if your grade point average is above a certain whatever grade point average, you could get into any school in Florida and it would be covered. The tuition would be covered like a state school. So I had this Florida Scholars Fund kind of scholarship.
Did you have any money in the bank?
Using it for community college.
Did you have money in the bank? Or I understand, did you say you worked at a Target or where did you work to make ends meet?
Yeah, when I moved to Tampa, I worked at Target. When I was still in Miami, I worked at Specs Records and Tapes.
Specs Music, the record store. Yeah.
Which is how I know Abel. And I think he was much more together and like more like of an assistant manager or something at the time. But he definitely like both worked at the Grove store and then both worked open. I helped open the South Beach store. That was when I was in my first year of college at Miami-Dade.
You did an associate's degree at Miami-Dade. Could I ask you, because there's this whole subculture, if you look at people in the 1970s, an older generation talking about women going to school, they're like, yeah, you know, there's a co-ed getting her associates. They kind of disdainfully look at co-education 50 years ago. But what was that associate's degree to you coming out of this traumatic period in this life? This was a way to get back on the grid for you to catch up, maybe get, finishing what high school couldn't offer you so that you could get into a four-year program?
Yeah, I mean, I just got my associate's as a part of like the two-year degree. So I started it at Miami-Dade. I was only there for 1 year and then I moved to Tampa and I finished at Hillsborough Community College. But it took me 4 years because I was working full-time in Tampa. I was working at Target. So I was working full time. And then basically after that, I realized like, I'm never going to finish school at this point. If it's taking so long, cause I could only take a couple classes at a time. So I called my mom and asked if I could move back home so that I could go to school full time. Then basically I moved back to Miami and started college at FIU full time, but immediately like moved in with a boyfriend.
Florida International University for a 4-year bachelor.
Yeah. But I also think like the way you look at it is like, You have such a different perspective. I think I was very much just like going day by day. Like it didn't have like a big picture plan in any way. It was just like, what do I do now? Like, okay, I finished high school. Now I need to go to college. So I didn't get to apply to any like 4-year school, like all my friends that went to FSU or UF or something. So I'll just go to the college that's local, you know, and just went to Dade. And I had to do it all myself. Like I wasn't getting help from my parents to like sign up for these things or any like trajectory of like, what are you going to do with your life, Vanessa? I didn't get any like sit down talks like that, you know?
having said that though, and I might be stating the obvious and I want the listeners to kind of marinate in this moment. Isn't it incredible that we have converged 30 years later? It doesn't matter that you went and got an associate's degree. I mean, you're Dr. Vanessa Sinclair now. My degree didn't really matter for what I wanted to do. I didn't study radio broadcast, public radio in college. You know, I was a public policy person and I was all premeditated and all planned and I wanted to go to this college and I wanted to go to this grad school. It ultimately took you how long to finish the undergraduate experience?
6 years.
6 or 7 years. So at the turn of the century, if I told you back then that we'd be talking in 25, 24 years and you'd be a psychoanalyst with a PhD in Scandinavia, what would that have struck you as?
Total fiction. I would think you were insane. Yeah, absolutely.
Insane in the DSM-3 sense or the legal sense. You went back and got a PhD. You just decided after finally finishing college that you wanted to study psychology.
Yeah, and my bachelor's was in psychology, and I went this whole roundabout way. I started in psychology, and then I thought maybe I would be an accountant, so I was taking economics classes. Then I took like an advertising class, and then I decided I was going to go to medical school, so I started taking all of the science classes that you needed to go to like be pre-med, and then that was just like, I really was not into like, especially organic chemistry. Organic chemistry is the one that killed me. I was like, yeah. I don't think this is the right direction for me. And so I was like, what should I do? And I just like looked at all my credits and was like, okay, if I just take this one abnormal psych class, then I can get a bachelor's in psychology. So that's why I chose it. And then like, what do you do with a bachelor's in psychology? Not much. So I was like, okay, what should I do? Okay, I'll go get a master's. But then like in Florida, at least at the time, if you had a master's, you always had to work like under somebody who had a doctorate or work in some sort of clinic. You couldn't have like a private practice. And so I decided like, well, I'll just get a doctorate then. So that's what I did. And just went again to the local school, Nova Southeastern University, because it was close by.
In Fort Lauderdale, Nova Southeastern. So in sum, you spent how long on both college, let's say associate's, bachelor's, and PhD?
Well, I graduated altogether in 95 from high school and went immediately to college that fall, in the fall of 95. And I finished in August 2007. So 12 years.
12 years. Wow. In closing, I mean, this is where I'd like you to take over the mic, Dr. Sinclair, on the book again, Things Happen, a novel, highly readable. I mean, the way, you know, your art is chopping up things and doing them episodically and very digestible. It's kind of a book that you could open at any spot and just get completely immersed and want to read the entire thing. You change some of the names. The memories remain very fresh and very raw. Whatever happened to this Miami? I mean, if you go back right now, it's a completely different world. Wall Street and hedge funds, the inflation that's there. I moved back between 1998 and 2000 to work there. It wasn't for me, but I'm ineluctably drawn back to this place as, I don't know, as a Rorschach, as a metaphor for what changes. I mean, Miami's always been in the imagination of people who were selling it. It was either swampland and a tropical paradise where you could tame the ravages of nature. You know, South Americans covet the property there. Others, Northerners, see themselves as snowbirds who want to go down and root for the Mets. To you and to me, I mean, it's a very different thing. Both of our childhood traumas are locked up in this place that's very much a fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I highly recommend, I tell everybody about your book. And I think the books go really well together. Read your book first so you can get the history, or you could do it either way, I guess. But I think they go really well together. And I, again, want to thank you for writing that book, because it basically kind of changed my life and helped inspire this book to exist. And like I think I told you when you were on my podcast, I really wish that Jessica was still alive and that she could learn all of this and know all of this, because she didn't know all of this history of that place. But that's why I wrote this book for her and dedicated it to her. So at least there's like a monument there. And I think also not just to her, but also, like you said, to that time. It's so different now. And everybody who I tell them I'm from Miami, they think of it like how it's advertised and it's all like beaches and fancy and celebrities and whatever. And it's like, it is that. And then there's this other side to it. And I guess I wanted to make sure that that was like captured. And it's also done this, you know, from the psychoanalytic point of view and also from a creative point of view, which I think really good art, like this book kind of to me is a work of art, in the sense that it like really took all these experiences and helped me process a lot. It took 3 years to put together, you know, I kept reworking things and writing things and having new memories come up. It was like a very psychoanalytic process, and then writing those down. And I also included like fragments of dreams that I had and things like that. So it's kind of really mixed up and surreal in that way. But it's also like, and allowed me to kind of put this time, like I'm talking about it now and I'm happy to, and I'm happy to like share what I went through. But it's also helped kind of like give it a place. Like now that time like lives in this book for me, and I don't feel like I have to carry it around so much. Like it doesn't feel as heavy for me now. It feels like, okay, I've written it down. It's there. It exists. I think these girls that live this life wanted people to know and wanted to be acknowledged and wanted, you know, people to know what they went through and how hard it was, what we went through. But it's good that it's, yeah, it has a place. It has recognition. People seem to love it. Everybody that I've given it to or that's bought it that I know says they read it in like 2 days. They just like sit down and read the whole thing over a weekend. So that's really nice to hear too, that it's a fun read. Yeah.
Well, I, for my part, I'm grateful that the world and the internet and the interconnectivity of it. I mean, here you are in Sweden, in a small town in Sweden. I'm in Virginia. We're connected over kind of a seamless interface on Riverside with high quality microphones. And it's like we're in the room together. It's clearly changed your practice. And I don't want to give away a spoiler from my book, but I encountered this property when you encountered it. You might well have been living on the 9th floor when I saw it.
I think I definitely was there.
And so to say, you know,
I remember that exact festival. So I was definitely wandering around.
To put all the cliche and everything aside, like what a great time that we live in, that we're able to connect and divulge. And I don't want to sound so cliche and say be vulnerable, but I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I've been able to meet you. I'd love to meet you in person when you come across the pond. Can you give us some of your social media particulars? The book, again, the novel is Things Happen by Vanessa Sinclair.
Absolutely. Well, my main website is drvanessasinclair.net. And then on social media, I'm Rawsin_RAWSIN_, because my full name is Vanessa Rawlings Sinclair. So I'm Rawsin_ on Instagram and Twitter. And then I also made an Instagram for my podcast, Rendering Unconscious. So
it's great to know you, Dr. Sinclair. Come back on.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Full disclosure, special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Notterly, Kim Zaninovich, and the University of Richmond. If you're listening to us on the radio, note that while we often cut for broadcast length, the entirety of every interview, every conversation is available on podcast. The link, please subscribe, please rate us, please tell your friends, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. It's all there, Podtopia, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, every podcatcher, and follow along on all social media at handle Full D Radio. A shout out to our listeners on NPR member station Radio IQ. Out in California, we are on KPPQ in Ventura. Message me if you'd like to carry Full Disclosure on your air. My DMs are always open, and catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening. Back with you next week.